From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. The Declaration of Independence is a defining document in the birth of the United States. But how much do we really know about this document? Was this more of a celebration of the birth of a new country, or more of a divorce document full of angry grievances against King George? What do we know about its origins? What was it meant to do, and its legacy over time and all around the world? Dr. Richard Bell will be talking about what he calls America's Birth Certificate on Thursday, April 25th, at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute in Boise. He's a teacher of early American history at the University of Maryland, and we're happy to have him back on the show. Hi, Dr. Bell.
It's great to be back with you, Gemma.
So let's just start with the basics. When was the Declaration of Independence written?
If only that was a simple question. we often associate it with, of course, one key date in American history. And do excuse my British accent. I'm a scholar of American history, despite this funny accent. We always associate it with one date, July the 4th, 1776. And yet, of course, there's a longer series of events involved which culminate in its authorship and circulation. So it is the result of a proposal to vote on independence. That proposal is made by a Virginia delegate to the Second Continental Congress. His name is Richard Henry Lee, and that proposal is June the 7th, 1776, not a date we tend to put much emphasis on these days, and with good reason, because that proposal went nowhere. On June the 7th, there was a sense that there weren't enough votes for it to pass, for independence as a vote to pass in the chamber on June 7th. So it got tabled for several weeks. And in the meantime, Congress appointed a committee of five of its own members to draft what you might usefully think of as a press release, so that if there ever was a vote on independence from Britain, and if that vote was successful, Congress would have a pre-drafted press release in its drawer, figuratively speaking, perhaps literally speaking, that they could push out to the American people and people around the world to explain why on earth they'd done this extraordinary thing, vote on independence. So between June 7th and early July, a committee of five people led by Thomas Jefferson, of course, and assisted by John Adams and Ben Franklin and Robert Livingston and Roger Sherman, they drafted a document, a press release that they could push out if independence was ever voted for. And on July the 2nd, that vote finally came around, and I'm pleased to report that it was successful. There were enough delegates willing to vote yes on independence for it to pass. And that's when the draft of the Declaration was pulled out of that drawer, and after some hasty editing was then circulated, both in the American colonies, which were now calling themselves the United States, of course, and around the world as well. So there's much more to it than simply July the 4th, 1776.
And so it really sounds like this was a collective group effort when it came to writing the Declaration of Independence. I mean, as you said, Thomas Jefferson kind of, you know, oversaw it, maybe the committee chair, right? But then there were a lot of other people involved in this process.
Yeah, I think both those things are true. So we should accurately give Jefferson the credit he deserves. I call him the lead draftsman, the head writer of the Declaration of Independence. And it's largely his work, with very modest input from the four other members of his committee. I'm sure we've all been on committees like that when one person does all the work, that goes for editing by the entire Second Continental Congress. So Jefferson's committee submits Jefferson's draft for consideration by the whole chamber for edits and revisions. And over two or three days at the end of June and early July, about 55 delegates, give or take a few, collectively edit Jefferson's work. And you would normally think that editing by committee, which some listeners may have had experience with, would be a death sentence for any sort of lyricism or poetry in the resulting document. But I'm very pleased to report, of course, and scholars generally are agreed on this, The edits the delegates in the main chamber made to Jefferson's draft largely helped to improve it. They made about, I think it was 86 alterations in all. They cut about 25% of Jefferson's original text. And the result was actually a leaner, cleaner, more powerful, more effective, more persuasive piece of writing. So when it comes to editing by committee, I think this is probably the exception, Gemma, that proves the rule.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that there would maybe be some controversial things that came up in the writing and the editing of the Declaration of Independence. In your opinion, what were some of those issues?
You're, of course, exactly right. So we today tend to focus only on what's called the preamble, the throat-clearing mm-hmm. opening sentences of the Declaration. The second paragraph is the one that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness." Jefferson saw those lines as just his introduction, and he saw the main import of the text as being in the subsequent paragraphs, the body paragraphs of this roughly 1,300 word long essay. Those body paragraphs are called the List of Grievances. And this is where Jefferson and the Continental Congress, by extension, makes the case to the American people and to the wider world that they have just cause to separate from Britain and assert their separate nationhood. And it's a list of roughly 24 grievances against Britain, and more narrowly against the British king, King George III. And he is indicted by Jefferson for a series of crimes and atrocities against the American colonists that date back to the Stamp Act and that culminate with George III sending German hired troops in 1776 over to the colonies to stamp out this rebellion. So this list of grievances, Gemma, is quite vitriolic. It's full of passion and anger and grief and hurt. You can feel Jefferson's sort of blood boiling a little bit when you read him express what the king has done. And according to members of the chamber who edited Jefferson, they thought that sometimes Jefferson got carried away. So they actually struck out one of Jefferson's grievances against King George. It was arguably the most controversial or incendiary one. It was a grievance in which Jefferson charged King George III with blame for the transatlantic slave trade. And you can see, of course, how Jefferson might want to blame everything on King George III to move the cause along. But many delegates thought that blaming a king who'd only been on the throne for 16 years since 1760 for a transatlantic traffic in captive Africans that dates back at least to 1619, if not earlier, you know, stretched credulity a little bit. It didn't make sense to average readers to blame a current king for a 200-year-old problem. So the delegates, I think, wisely struck that one out. They also tightened up some of the language in the other lists of grievances to either amp them up or tamp them down, depending on which one we're talking about. But still, if you read it today, it will make your blood boil. It will make your hair stand on end to see all the crimes that King George is accused of. And if it has that effect, Gemma, it's then still effective, still persuasive, even today.
So with all of that being said, would you say that this really was more of like a severing, like a divorce from King George, rather than the birth of a new country? Or can they live simultaneously together in that document?
Oh, I love complexity, Gemma. So I say yes to both of those options. It is a divorce announcement, and that analogy of two consenting individuals going their separate ways if the marriage is not working is an analogy that some people at the time used. Thomas Paine was one of the people who made that analogy. Paine also offered another analogy, which has been perhaps the more enduring one, which is of a child growing up and leaving home, which is the dominant analogy for thinking about American independence, right? That there's something natural about a child who is at once dependent on their parents, growing up, maturing, and no longer being dependent on their parents. So that sort of analogy hangs over this moment of separation. Simultaneously, it does mark the birth of an independent nation. And it's worth bringing in here, Gemma, one of the, I think, likely audiences for the Declaration of Independence. We reflexively tend to assume that the readership of the Declaration is intended to be the American people or King George, but arguably the most important readers for this document Jefferson was drafting were the French government and the Spanish government, international powers in Western Europe, who the Patriots desperately needed military alliance with if their rebellion, their insurgency, their insurrection was to have a prayer of actually succeeding. And many people at the time, including Richard Henry Lee, who first proposed American independence, they are very explicit that the reason to write this manifesto, the reason to declare that their insurgency is real, is to draw Britain's European rivals, France and Spain, off the sidelines and into the war on the Patriot side, to make independence viable, because without foreign assistance, arguably, independence was not going to be realized.
So I know that you've called the Declaration America's birth certificate, as I said in the introduction, but you've also said the purpose has been misunderstood. So can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, so it's all these things, of course, right? So I think we in this country have an incomplete understanding of what's momentous and important and wonderful and significant about the Declaration of Independence. It does serve ultimately to help draw France and Spain off the sidelines. So in that sense, it serves its purpose. And by drawing France and Spain ultimately off the sidelines, it makes political independence not just a goal, but actually something achievable. Because with France's navy and Spain's navy, the Patriots are finally able to match British naval power on the high seas, hold the Royal Navy at bay, distract the Royal Navy by going after their possessions in the Caribbean, in India and Canada, expanding it into a global war, which the Patriots could not do on their own. And that ultimately brings on British defeat in 1781, 1782, 1783. And it's British defeat, of course, that marks the meaningful birth of American independence, that the British army leave the field by 1782. They sign a global peace treaty acknowledging American independence by 1783. And so arguably that moment, British acknowledgement of American independence, is when America's independence becomes meaningful, when the nation is birthed in any hopefully permanent and lasting way. So we've got all these competing metaphors, Gemma, about birth, about children growing up, about parents divorcing, but they all amount to the same idea, which is the written document is a set of promises, a set of intentions, a commitment to separate nationhood, which the Patriots very much hope they'll be able to realize over time. So there's a lot more going on than Jefferson and his friends signing a piece of paper as if that by magic and of itself achieves American independence. It's not. Mm. It's a promise. It's a hope. It's an aspiration. It's a manifesto for what will come next.
Do you have a favorite part of the Declaration of Independence?
Oh, what a great question. So I always want to tell people I get to talk to about this, about the list of grievances, because it is the central part of the Declaration. It's the reason for the Declaration. It's the moment when Jefferson explains what the motive for independence is and what the case for independence is. And you need a motive and you need a case if you're going to successfully persuade people that separate nationhood is desirable. So that section, the list of grievances, is certainly way more important than we give it credit for. But like every other American, and I'm now a proud naturalized U.S. citizen, I am drawn to the famous lines as well. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that I think life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is an admirable set of goals for all of us Americans to try to realize over time. And even though Jefferson perhaps meant some fairly narrow things when he wrote those words, we all know that he was a white man of considerable property who owned enslaved people. What's been so splendid about the Declaration of Independence since Jefferson wrote it, and it's now almost 250 years old, is how other Americans, later Americans, have seized on Jefferson's throwaway lines in the preamble about equality and liberty and use them as rallying cries for meaningful civil rights. All men are created equal was one of the rallying cries of Frederick Douglass and other proponents of the destruction of slavery and black civil rights. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech is founded on the idea of making the Declaration's promises of equality actually meaningful to African Americans in the 20th century. We've seen Native American rights, women's rights, gay marriage rights, trans rights, all predicated on making those promises of equality meaningful for all Americans, not just people who looked and sounded like Thomas Jefferson. And I think that's what's magical about the Declaration today.
You know, it must be something to think about that if Thomas Jefferson were alive today, right? He could just pop in and see everything that you just said, where what has transpired from the Declaration of Independence when it comes to equal rights. I do think he was a forward-thinking individual for his time overall. I wonder if he could have even fathomed the lasting impact of this document.
I think that's right. I think it is unfathomable to an 18th century mind, not least because Jefferson's writings are all over the place. You can read parts of Jefferson's writings as very anti-slavery and forward-thinking, if you put it a moment ago. You can also find Jefferson taking actions that rub against that, right? Jefferson owns more enslaved people when he dies in 1826 than he did on the day he wrote All Men Are Created Equal. So he's a very confusing, head-scratching figure. It's what makes him so fascinating for biographers, and there are lots of great biographers out there. But if I could make one more point about what he might make if he were here, of this world we've built out of the Declaration of Independence, it's that the ramifications of that extraordinary document are not just felt in America. In the last 250 years, the majority of nations that have come into existence around the world have written their own declarations of independence against the British Empire or the Spanish Empire, the Portuguese Empire, the French Empire, all of which are, to a greater or lesser extent, in imitation of the American Declaration. So it's not just America's birth certificate. It's become a blueprint for other groups of people seeking self-determination and sovereignty for themselves. And we have seen through the replication of declarations of independence by rights seekers in other places, we've seen a world of nation states emerge out of the ashes of a world of empires. So that's arguably something Jefferson and his friends in Philadelphia can take a little bit of credit for.
Would you say that that's the lasting legacy of the Declaration of Independence, or is there something more?
It's sorry to interrupt you, Gemma. It's certainly the global legacy of the Declaration of Independence that's become a necessary step for rights seekers to author as they make their own path to seek independence. So we saw many of the former Soviet republics of the Soviet Empire, like Ukraine, adopt declarations of independence. We saw independent nations emerging from the British Empire adopt declarations of independence. It's been particularly prominent in the former colonies of the Spanish Empire, which began their journey towards independence right after America's in the 1790s and 1800s and 1820s. So I think the global legacy is how declaring independence has become an important step to achieving independence. And then I think more narrowly, that simple phrase, all men are created equal, has been expanded and expanded and expanded to include not just white men of property, but all of us. And I think that's a wonderful transformative legacy as well. So there's two equally impressive things at work here.
I'm curious, before I let you go, is there one part of the Declaration of Independence that people should critically understand? Or is it truly really the entire legacy of this document that we've just talked about?
I think you're onto something there with that last point, Gemma, that the legacy of the Declaration is wonderfully complicated and multifaceted and can't be easily boiled down to one soundbite. But the global implications and legacy as a blueprint for decolonization is a transformative moment in the history of the modern world. And to the extent that it provides language to think about human rights in a new way, then that should never be minimized or obscured either.
Well, I want to thank you so much for this conversation. It has been really fascinating, and I've really appreciated it.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Richard Bell, professor of history at the University of Maryland. He'll be talking about America's birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence. He'll be in Boise Thursday, April 25th at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.